Welcome to Wyoming Stories. I'm Micah Schweitzer. This podcast brings you stories about Wyomingites in their own words. Our first piece this month takes us to the Tetons, where we'll meet Bill Briggs. He's a Dartmouth graduate from Maine, and after college, he moved to Jackson Hole, where he became North America's father of extreme skiing. In Jackson, he worked as a climbing and ski guide for many years, and in 1971, he was the first person ever to descend Grand Teton on skis. His friend Spark M. asks him to describe the experience.
Did you come up with this idea yourself to ski the Grand?
It was just pushed along. And you're in an environment in with personalities that were encouraging. It was sort of expected. I'd like to tell the story of being in the Shady Lady Bar at Snow King, and we're sitting around the table, and I'm saying the Grand could be skied, and they said, no, it's impossible. Couldn't be done, so I had to do it. That was the final straw. The next thing was to go do it. So basically, I was alone, which is okay. I've only got myself to take care of here. And doing something that's that far out, I was happy to do by myself.
So what happened? You're on the top of the mountain.
Oh, on top?
Mm-hmm.
Boy. The problems that you have, in those days, you didn't have plastic straps to hold on crampons. They were leather. You get to the top of the mountain, you have to take the crampons off. Now, getting the right one off, I have to do behind my back. Normally, you can just reach down, but I can't reach the foot to the fused hip. So I have to do this behind my back, and I find out the strap is frozen. Now you have to warm up the hand and then unfreeze the strap and go back and forth that way half a dozen times. Finally get the strap off. Now you get the crampons off and you're on a crusted surface, and you can put on the downhill ski. Now, when you go to put on the uphill ski and you lean over and there is no flat ground, all you have is this rounded egg shape at the top of the mountain. And you go down to put the other ski on, and the one that you're standing on starts to go forward around the egg. To get the second ski on was a real challenge. I mean, that's really difficult. Then skiing down, that's easy. Very tight in between the rocks off the summit. It's very narrow going on a hard crust and just wonderful, fun skiing. I must say, I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed fitting the skis through on that. I know I'm going to break through the crust at some point, who knows when. And when the skis do break through, I fall over downhill, and you roll over and get right back up again. It's a nonstop action, which I'm used to doing. No problem. Sit right back up and ski down Petzold Ridge, and it's narrowing. It's got a cornice on one side and rocks on the other. The snow is perfect. The skis are perfect. I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, how could it be any better? And then you go out on the east face. The east face, I know, is going to slide. The thing is to pick the exact place where the slide will break off. I had spotted just where I wanted to go on the way up. So it was a matter of cutting across and making sure it would slide. So I cut across, and boy, it slid just perfect. And you just back up a little and ski down where it had slid off. So all the snow had gone by the other guys down below waiting, and they figured I was in that. When I go down, I do the final bit through that narrow, steep, narrower than my skis were long. So you didn't have much room. Skiing through, and the tails of skis hit on a right-hand turn, hit the rocks. No great problem, but that was a really tricky thing to pull off. That's the big challenge. skiing through there. I don't know many, if anybody, has since done it. They all rappel that. I didn't have a rope. I couldn't rappel it. I had to ski it. So ski down, pull up behind the other guys, and they weren't even looking. I pull up. Where did you come from? The rest of the way down, wonderful adventure. Good corn snow, but a pretty bad runnel. Skiing across the runnel, I started a bit of a slide, and the other guys are down below me, so you roll over and put one ski tip in and bury it in the slide, and the slide stops, and that stops the avalanche from going.
So what happened when you were walking down the end of this?
Oh, on the trail down. Yeah, you get down on the trail. You came across a couple who were coming up. And yeah, they asked, where have you, you know, you've been skiing? Yeah, so where did you ski up on the Grand Teton? For how high up from the top? How many times? You know, just once. Oh, that's too bad.
So, Bill, when you got back to the bar, the Shady Lady or wherever, then what?
No one would believe it. No one would believe it that night. So the next day I go up to the airport, and I could see the tracks from the airport. Without binoculars, I could see tracks up there. So I called up Ginny Heidi Cooper at the guide. And she said, stay right there, and I'll come up, and we'll go take a picture of it. And the picture's been a wonderful thing.
It's very elegant.
Yeah.
That was Bill Briggs talking with his friend Spark M. Briggs was the first person ever to ski down Grand Teton. This piece was produced with help from Cordelia Zars. We're now going to hear from Dale Barber, who was 24 years old when she moved to Jackson Hole in the 1960s. She worked at the Wirt Hotel, a historic inn in the heart of the city. And as we'll hear, her uniform at the Wirt involved a seemingly indestructible skirt.
I was working in the coffee shop when I first went to work there. They had a dining room, but there was a pecking order. You had to kind of work your way up. You know, they didn't let just anybody work in the dining room. And they told you you had to wear a uniform. You had to have a white blouse and a black skirt. They gave you the skirt. You had to furnish the blouses. So this skirt was, I have no clue what it was made out of. You just pulled it on, you know, and it was like straight and it hit you about knee length. And it had pockets, and you wore a little apron over it and everything. But anyway, you only got one. So we would go to work, stay out too late, party too hard, come home, realize, oh my gosh, the skirt, you know, because you're in a restaurant, so you've got everything on it. Get up in the morning, get ready, dunk the skirt in the sink, you know, and kind of wash it around and scrub it a little bit and everything. And then I'd go out and get in my car, and I could drive from Wilson to Jackson and hold the skirt out the window. You had to hold it out the window, and you're driving, and the skirt would dry between Wilson and Jackson so that when I got to work, I could put the skirt on. It was clean. I was good to go. So I worked for the Word about 4 years. The skirt, when I left, I had to turn it in. It looked exactly the way it looked the first day. I don't know what they were made out of, but they were unbelievable. And that was with all that abuse, you know, not cleaning it at the last minute, holding it out the car window. 4 years later, I'm sure they passed it on to somebody else.
Dale Barber lives in Jackson Hole, and she worked at the Wirt Hotel when she was in her 20s. The piece was produced by Adrian Shirk and Jennifer Tenekin. In our final piece this month, we meet another Jackson resident, Charlie Thomas. He used to work as a rafting guide at Lewis and Clark River Expeditions.
Rod Lewis owned Lewis and Clark Rafting, and back in 1980, I started working for them. And I guess about 81 or so, Rod decided to start Floatographs. And the idea behind Floatographs was to take pictures of people rafting down the Snake, and then he would sell those pictures back to the people when they got done with their trip. So most of the time, he photographed the rafts from the opposite side of the river as the road was on. So he had to get the film back across the river. So he had all sorts of different ideas about how to get the film back across the river. And the idea was to get the film back to town before the customers showed up on the bus, so that when they stepped off the bus, voila, there were their pictures for sale. So Rod started out, his first idea was to get a guy on a motorcycle who was supposed to drive the film back into town. And so first they had to get the film across the river to the guy on the motorcycle. And initially he had all sorts of different schemes. He tried casting, having the photographers cast it across the river with a fishing rod, which didn't work. They couldn't get it all the way across. And then he tried having them tie it to an arrow and shoot it across the river. And they kept losing the film that way too. And so finally, then Rod strung a wire across the river, and they would put the film on a little pulley, and it would go, across on this wire. But then one day during high water, one of the other rafts coming down the river ended up, the guide snagged the cable and took the whole thing down. So that also failed. So then he decided that our number one job as guides was to make sure that film somehow got across the river. So the photographers would load up the film in this little plastic bag, this little floaty yellow bag. And when we came down, they would snap the pictures and then heave the film across out into the river. And we were supposed to somehow get the customers. These were U-paddle trips. And the people were paddling the raft. And we were supposed to get the people to turn the boat around and paddle back upstream to try to save this film that was floating down in the middle of the rapids. And needless to say, it wasn't working out very well. Rod, I remember one day Rod coming down, and he's angry with us because we'd lost yet another thing of film. And he's like, "What is the number one most important thing on the river?" And we're like, "Safety?" And he's, "No, it's the film! The film! Make sure the film gets..." And so none of it was working very well. And Floatographs, had a pretty bad record because mostly the people weren't able to see their pictures. So he didn't have that captive audience. So finally, one day, Rod came up with the idea of pigeons. And he decided he was going to take passenger pigeon. Well, he got these racing pigeons, and he was going to put the film on the racing pigeons. So all the money from Lewis and Clark, which was a profitable business, started going into these pigeons. And he built this pigeon coop. It was, they had, at the time, they had this building moratorium. I think the height of the highest building in Jackson could only be two stories high. But Rod somehow managed to build on top of another building this pigeon coop that was three stories up, towering over everything in Jackson, was Rod's pigeon coop. And he spent oodles of money training these pigeons, and he would took them to California so they could have a warm place where they could practice all the pigeoning. And he had these schemes for the pigeons. he would starve them of food or of sex, and they would be so they would be motivated to fly back to the pigeon coop faster. And finally, you know, the day came when Rod was ready. He sewed these little jock straps for these pigeons where the film was supposed to be placed, and he was ready for the pigeons to make their maiden voyage. And so the photographers took these pigeons down to the river, and they took their pictures, and they put the film in the pigeon and sent it up in the air, and the pigeon just beelined towards Jackson. And apparently these things were fast. They would go like 60 miles an hour. They easily beat the bus back there. The people, as soon as they stepped off the bus, there was their picture. Sales were just roaring. It was a huge success. Everybody was excited. And then the Forest Service decided that they needed to plant some peregrine falcons along the river. Now, these racing pigeons are the fastest birds out there. The eagles can't keep up with them. The only thing that can catch a racing pigeon is a peregrine falcon. And all of a sudden, the Forest Service decided to plant these peregrine falcons along the river. So Rod, you know, he at first didn't realize, know what was happening, but he was lost a couple pigeons, and he couldn't figure out what was becoming of his pigeons. So he started, you know, going along the highway there and tracking the pigeons, and that's when he saw a peregrine falcon. And Rod, he was of the old school, where he felt that the government had nothing to do with private industry, and he felt completely justified in protecting his interests, you know, against the government. And so Rod got himself a shotgun, which had plenty of them, and he went down there, and he decided he was going to protect his pigeons against those peregrine falcons. Well, the Forest Service didn't agree, and I think that was about the time that Rod ended up in prison. But he didn't actually get arrested for killing any of the falcons, but he got arrested for having a run-in with a Forest Service employee and nearly killing him. But Rod's pigeons did continue to carry the film and were successful for many years until, with only a small attrition rate to peregrine falcons, until I think he eventually sold it.
That was Jackson resident Charlie Thomas. He used to work as a rafting guide. And that's it for this edition of Wyoming Stories. We'll be releasing a new edition the first Monday of each month from now on. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Willow Belden produced this podcast, and Anna Rader is our web editor. You can find each of the stories you heard today and many others online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. If you have a story you'd like to tell, we'd love to hear from you. Information about recording your story is available on our website. Wyoming Stories is a production of Wyoming Public Media.